The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and my guest on The Breakfast Grill this morning is Dr. Elsa Lafayette-Dimichaud, a political economist and associate professor at Rennie University. She's also the author of the book, The Development of Malaysian Capitalism, From British Rule to the Present Day. And she's also published a co-authored work on the relationship between Malaysia and the People's Republic of China. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
We'll leave the question of China till later, but I want to begin with a remark made by a well-known Malaysian economist, Jomo K. Sundram, who says that your work addresses the prophets of doom and naysayers who have difficulty explaining the nation's impressive growth record over the decades. And that's probably a good place to start. There are people who have expected the system to fall apart because of NEP, because of maybe corruption and the like, and yet we see impressive results in terms of GDP and growth and such. Taking a step back and looking at the system as a whole, can you explain to us why you think the system works?
As I am an economist in development studies, and in France, Malaysia is absolutely not known among the economists. And the debate we have between us is about the non-development of Africa in the 90s, the problems in North Africa, the Latin America up and down and crisis. And I was in middle of these exchanges dealing with the Malaysian economy. And from this very international and comparative perspective, yes, I can tell you that Malaysia is doing extremely well because it's at the same time has been developing itself and has been taking very seriously the income inequalities. And on a world point of view, it's at the same time well done, not perfectly done, but quite well done and very impressive. And also now, since maybe 5-10 years, the international organization are talking about inclusive growth. It means you have not only to grow for the as a macroeconomist administrations and government, but you are also to be careful of including every group, social groups in the dynamic. But Malaysia did it since 1970. And at that time, it was very unique. And the result is there.
No, so, okay. So on the face of it, you've given us, a, you know, 5 stars, a good rating. People will say, oh, does that make you an apologist for the system? Because they will see in the NEP inequalities, discrimination between different ethnic communities. When you talk about the political system, they see corruption. We've had the debacle of 1MDB. So they say, well, how can you say this? How can you give the thumbs up to an administration or government, successive administrations, when in fact we have all these rather negative, you know, factors as well?
Mm-hmm. So I just tried to analytically separate the topics. And when you look at the Malaysian economy, you cannot say it's a failure.
So
it does not mean that I support the NEP, especially maybe as a social scientist, choosing to make affirmative action towards one group. It means distributing growth on the basis of the belongings to this race and not to this race. It's really a political choice. It's not neutral. It's really very heavy of consequences.
You start with this idea that the NEP, in some sense, is, in the first instance, is a political consensus. It's an agreement on values in terms of the role of the state, the role of the free market or free enterprise in this country, and also redistribution of social goods. But tell us, what has gone into the mix to make this system operate and deliver the goods, mm-hmm, in terms of economic growth, at least?
Indeed, because of all these choices, Malaysia has created a three-engine accumulation regime. It means the capitalism is not relying on only one source of capital production, investment, and then profit redistribution to the capital, which is growing up, etc. The accumulation regime, the internal engine of the economy, is indeed three sub-engines. One is local capitalist classes, which are mainly Chinese from the end of the 19th century, early 20s.
This just SMEs, the smaller medium price and also sized enterprises,
yeah,
or more
and also
than
big companies.
Okay.
Yeah. So this that we have a private capitalism in Malaysia, which has its own history and is has faced some shocks, especially with the ACA regime of investment before the 80s, so before 86. So this is one, but it's only one. In many countries, the capitalism is only relying on this group and it can face historical shocks or economic shocks. But together with this one, which is maybe more traditional for capitalist country, you have also the state, which is entering the Malaysian capitalism with the NEP. It was not the case before. This is the main rupture. And Mahathir has given this system its big importance for the country. And now Najib with the GLCs, and Terence Gomez is studying it very well, very in detail in his last book on MOF.inc. This part of the regime of accumulation in Malaysia, which is linked to the state, is super massive and quite, in a way, powerful. And he plays his biggest role when the rest of the economy is a bit down. So he's adjusting to the conjuncture because it's directly politically driven. But we don't have only this. We have also the external entrance of investment in Malaysia. And it used to be the British ones, but the British investment in Malaysia, where the capital has been colonizing Malaysia at the end of the 19th century from the Europe. So this was running, and you know, Malaysia was a very profitable British possession. But this was not very, all the profits were sent back to Europe. So for developing Malaysia, it was not the best engine. But today, since the 70s also, when the administration of Malaysia did welcome foreign direct investment, the most important one at that time were the U.S. Semiconductor investments. They were based first in Penang, and then they have been also in Selangor and Johor. All this investment from the outside has created another engine of growth and of capital accumulation in this country. So you have three. You enjoy three. It's okay. Very much, and it allows one to be weaker, then the other one can be stronger. And that's how Malaysia growth has been sustained quite strongly during all these three, four decades.
Now, okay, some people will say, I understand local capital, they produce value. I understand foreign capital, they do the same, they set up factories and employ people. But the state is often seen not as an engine of growth. The state is often seen as, you know, taxing the other two sectors. And the impression is that the state is bloated, it's got too many civil servants. It is sucking the lifeblood out of those other two sectors. Now, you give a very different picture. You're claiming that the state is an engine of growth, similar to both domestic capital as well as foreign capital. Could you explain that?
It's a very deep debate, and in political economy is maybe the most lasting debate between the role of the state and the role of the market in the economy. It's totally ideological, the two views. So I try not to be ideological. I try just to look. Here I try to look closely to the importance and the effect of the role of the state in Malaysia. And there has been a recent debate and a very good publication by Menon about the crowding out effect. Is the Malaysian state companies crowding out the private investment in Malaysia?
And the state has become too big, it's crowded out the others.
Yeah, okay, it means he's investing in a place, it should be the private companies that had to invest in this place, etc. But why? It's quite ideological. When you say it should be, it means you have a normative idea of what should be the capitalism. And if you have, it's what I'm bringing into the debate, is a more fine, maybe refined view of what is capitalism and the fact that it's diverse, very deeply diverse. You could go a bit further in this discussion. I think, depending of the sectors, of course, depending also of the moments, the GLCs, in the 80s, there were debates to say they were not so productive. But I think today the picture is, you know, they have modernized very much. Sometimes they're even so big that they had to operate outside Malaysia. That is one of the source of the flow of outward flow of investment from Malaysia to the rest of the world. So I think they have really been part of the modernization of Malaysia, and not they are not so far behind indeed.
So, okay, so you have this picture you paint of three engines, and it's a perfectly balanced system. Are there dysfunctions in the system?
On a moral point of view, corruption is totally condemnable and is a dysfunction. So, of course, I could say only that. But when you look how it works, you say, okay, it's dysfunctioning, but it's for something dysfunctioning, it's running well. Capitalism in Malaysia has always overcome its crisis. And the biggest internal contradictions have not yet been exploding or devastating the system.
So what are those internal contradictions?
Is at the pinnacle of the structure organizing the capitalism in Malaysia, there is a state-economy relationship, even framing the international integration into the global order. At the
bottom
of the structure, you have labor. You have the labor condition, labor, the definition of wages, etc. And for me, that could be seen as a problem itself, so maybe. But also, the problem is that the education, which is nurturing the quality of this labor in Malaysia, is not good enough qualitatively, maybe also quantitatively, but especially qualitatively. So the labor, which is already subaltern, is not nurtured by education, which will help this dimension to sustain the Malaysian capitalism for very long. If you look at where is Malaysia capitalism at the middle, at the moment, is between the export-led industrialization capitalism, like Thailand, and between Korea, Taiwan, Japan. Is in between. The level of GDP per capita is nearly in between, more closer to Thailand, but not so far from the Korean one. But the main difference is the ability to do true innovation, the ability to be really performing well as human resources. Of course, maybe the GLCs, with their way of functioning, are a bit protecting this not enough well-trained people to be exposed to the world competition, etc. So for the moment, it's working well. Maybe that should be addressed in the next decade. And quite, I think it already your government wants to address it and does not know how to do it properly.
I'm speaking to Dr. Elsa Lafayette de Michaud, a political economist and the author of the book, The Development of Malaysian Capitalism from British Rule to the Present Day. Next up, we speak about our relationship with the People's Republic of China. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutin, and I'm speaking to Dr. Elsa Lafayette de Michaud, a political economist and the author of the book, The Development of Malaysian Capitalism from British Rule to the Present Day. You also have a book which you co-authored with two others on the special relationship between Malaysia and the People's Republic of China. It's called Malaysia-China's Precious Relationship. Could you tell us what is it that you were trying to achieve and what is it that you were looking at?
We have been three writing this book. One is David Delfoli, which is a doctor in political sciences from France. The other one is Nathalie Faux. She's a French geographer. She has been based here maybe 4 or 5 years, very recently, studying the maritime space of Southeast Asia, and Malaysia has been very important for her. We were trying to study in depth during 2 years the changing patterns of the Malaysia-China relationship.
Because this has become highly politicized in recent times, the concerns that have been brought up in the political rivalry that's ongoing in the country at the moment. There's a lot of emotions around this question. I mean, some see this as a good thing, some not so. What is it that you're contributing to our understanding of this relationship?
Every country in the world today is saying we have a special relation with China. And when you look China's special relation, you will have so many countries being proud of saying that they have a special relationship. And we want to say precious, because precious, it means for both sides, it's valuable, and you have to take care of this. In our book, to look at the relationship from the Malaysian point of view. We are not sinologues, we are not specialists of China, but we are specialists of Malaysia. So we could see from Malaysia how it's coming closer, and how it's what happened and what are the effects. And very interestingly, I came first to study this topic in the summer 2013. And I came out of this first fieldwork, very, very intensive, with the UMNO representative, with the Chinese Chamber of Commerce representative, with the Malaysian Civil Society representative, with scholars. So from this, I came back with the view that at that time, 2013 is very recent, there were a wide consensus saying it's good. Malaysia-China relation is something precious, is good for the country. It was a consensus crossing all the society, from the Islamist one to the very democratic civil societies, people from UMNO to PAS and DAP, they all say, oh, we are lucky to have this good relation with China. I think only 3-4 years after, things have changed. And now the political debate is also divided along difference in views of the China relation. And I think I can explain it. Is because the economic relationship, which has been really the engine of this rapprochement, was first in trade. Trade between Malaysia and China has improved very, very much since the late 90s. Late 90s, 2000, you can see the curve, boop, 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 the trade between Malaysia and China is growing, 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 growing. Then, because of the new importance of bilateral trade, there have been the idea has emerged from China to make monetary cooperation. If the bilateral trade is enormous, then it's really a problem to have always, for all this amount of money, to exchange ringgit into dollar and then dollar into yuan. So they make cooperation in order to save time, money, commission, and transaction cost in this operation, which became so numerous and for such amount. So you had, at the same time, developing a trade relation very becoming more and more important. And you know, in 2009, China became the first trade partner of Malaysia. At that time, the government could say it's really fantastic. We became so important for China. Now we are the number one with them in ASEAN. It was so very easy to say it's very good because Malaysia was benefiting of the export less import differential. But very soon after, maybe 2011, 2012, already China became the one benefiting in the bilateral trade. So
we have a balanced trade issue.
Now is a negative.
I want to bring us back to the discussion we had in the first part, where you talk about the three pistons, the sub-engines, right? How does this story of China relate to that picture that you gave us? Because one of the sub-engines is foreign investment. So does this just fit neatly into that sub-engine story? Or is it growing to the extent that it's going to change the relationship between the three sub-engines?
I think 2009, China becomes the first external partner of Malaysia for trade, not investment yet. Investment, it comes much later. But for trade, 2009, China is first one, and China is growing fast, and China is buying more and more things from Malaysia. And 2009 is the GFC crisis. So Malaysia is experimenting a shock on its trade part. And it could have been very much destroying. But because at the same moment, China is becoming more important and having its own dynamic, which has been not very much impacted by the GFCs, so much less than in Europe and US. You know, in Europe, we are not completely recovered yet of the crisis. So if Malaysia was only relying on trade with US and Europe, it would have suffered much more. But because China was growing up in the relationship with Malaysia, it has been saved in a way by this very timely new relation. And when you study Malaysia-China relationship, it's also a question of chance and of time. The right time. China has been here at the right time to support Malaysian economy, and it means also to support Najib Razak, very objectively.
And so what about the future? I mean, have we tied our economy too tightly to China's economy, and could there be trouble down the road?
Yes, you have tied your economy very neatly and closely with China in the last 10 years, and even more in the last 5 years, because if you look at the investment from the all over the world to Malaysia, China was still number four investing in Malaysia in 2014. In 2014 is yesterday, only number four, but already today number one. So it's in a, you know, when you...
In the blink of an eye.
In the blink of an eye, China has become number one for Malaysian investment. So it's very impressive. Does it mean that Malaysia has lost its sovereignty? I don't know. And now it's a question of political choice, political ability. Can you be close to China still being yourself as a nation? The next years will tell us this story. For me, if I see the structure of Malaysian capitalism, I think China will not change the structure. It's nurturing the trade dimension, it's nurturing the investment. Maybe I have given a talk in front of Maida for them to be aware of what is happening. And they were saying to me, you open our eyes, you enlighten us very much, because we don't have the whole picture. So Malaysia-China relationship was very much nurtured by trade because of Malaysian-Chinese old relations and common origins. But it was people-to-people relationship until the 2014, something like that. And then with Najib, after the general election, the 13th general election, then there may be a turn in the state-to-state relationship between Malaysia and China. And now the nature of the relationship was people-to-people, mainly based on the Malaysian-Chinese community, now with much more state-to-state, party-to-party. UMNO has a MOU with the Chinese Communist Party since, I think, 2009. And then they have... make contracts, agreements on many, many, many things. Kuantan Port, Kuantan Industrial Park, Penang Bridge, Johor Development, etc. So now there is a new page. Yeah. And another thing is that there have been the US-China rivalry before Trump was something major in the region, in the world and in the region. And the China-US rivalry, you could see it in the 2015, 16, it was clearer then. You could see the refraction of this rivalry, geopolitical major rivalry, among the Malaysian internal political game. And what was a broad consensus in 2013 has changed because of this rivalry having effect here. And maybe the U.S. may be supporting the Anwar and opposition more, and the China very linked to UMNO, and UMNO relying on this good relation with China to operate things, to have projects, to develop the country, to develop the East Coast, because East Coast was never evenly developed compared to the West Coast, etc., addressing some important issues together with China. So now the consensus, the wide consensus from the 2013 has been broken during this evolution.
I look forward to the translation of this book. When can we expect the book to be translated in English?
So unfortunately, it's already translated and now we are having discussion with publishers. So we hope it will be published in Singapore very soon.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Sharad.
I've been speaking to Dr. Elsa Lafayette de Michaud, political economist and the author of the book, The Development of Malaysian Capitalism from British Rule to the Present Day. I'm Sharad Kutin. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, the business station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.